and then to kind of die down a little bit using it. So one example might be like smartphones, for instance, right? So smartphones first came out, whatever, 2000s, right? They got so much hype. Everyone started using them, right? And to me, it's now or in the next 10 years that people are going to start being like, hey, it's actually really bad that I'm spending so much time on my phone. Can I find really good ways to not do this, right? Because we're not used to it. It's almost like maybe drinking in moderation or something, where when you're first introduced to drink, you don't even know what it is, right? So you're thinking, oh, like, I can do this a lot. And once you start to realize the downfalls, it takes even longer to be like, okay, how can I work on this, right? So kind of humanity goes through these things as well. And so I think this is something that happened with smartphones, where people kind of use them a lot. We're kind of peaking in terms of how much we use them. And then people are kind of slowly being like, I actually really do enjoy like human connection. So in the last, whatever, year, I've heard more and more stories of people being like, yeah, I try to use my phone as little as possible. Or I'm actively trying to stop using my phone, which is something that maybe wasn't as true 5 years ago. So I really think that AI will go through something similar, where kind of right now everyone is using it. And in the future, maybe next 5 years, 10, depends, timeline is hard to say when things move so quickly, it'll get even more widely adopted and people will use it for many, many tasks. And then maybe at some point people will be like, we're actually losing some stuff for using it so much. But I think if this is going to happen, very far away.
Yeah, awesome. Well, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. It's been super fun.
Yeah. You've been listening to Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh. I'm your host, Archin Das, and I've been here with AI researcher at CMU, Maxwell Jones. Thanks. Have a good one, folks.
Peace.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
Hi, I'm Richard Gordon, and welcome to Forbes Avenue here on WRCT Pittsburgh. On May 7th of 2024, I had the privilege of interviewing bassist Ron Carter, right around the time he turned 87 years old. And before I share the conversation we had, let's play a number from his catalog. This is from a 2006 record where he collaborated with guitarist Bill Frisell and drummer Paul Motion. And it's a trio version of a song that Ron Carter wrote with Miles Davis called 81. a privilege it is to have Ron Carter on the phone with us here on Forbes Avenue. And what you just heard was Ron Carter, Bill Frisell, and Paul Motion playing 81. Thank you so much for joining us, Mr. Carter.
Good morning to you and yours.
I think that track is really interesting because it's a something you wrote, co-wrote with Miles Davis, but it comes out totally different in a trio format with Bill Frisell and Paul Motion.
You know, I miss Paul. Paul was a wonderful drummer. He knew melodies, he knew form, he knew dynamics, he knew how to listen. And boy, drum world misses a wonderful influence on them as he's left the scene. It's always fun to play Bill. It's always fun to hear him. And I try to do that whenever I can to see what I missed last time working with him. a good band.
One thing that's fascinating to me about all of Bill Frisell's work, and for you too, is balancing that written music against the improvisation.
Well, I think two things, Mr. Gordon. We've kind of gotten used to leaving our ego at home, one, and two, bringing both ears to the gig. And if you have that combination, you find nice things to do.
You've played in large groups and led large groups and small groups. You've been in over 2,200 recording dates. What kinds of things stand out to you over the years of experience?
I'm always surprised that the calls I get that are not necessarily jazz bands or jazz-oriented gigs, so that after all the choices that they have, they decided this guy, me, has the best chance of making their music do something that they hope it can do. All the good players come to New York. That's what we're all about here. And with the travel situation being what it is, it's easy to get to New York in a moment's notice. So that they have chosen me for their projects as a tribute to recorded sounds and social media and stuff like that. But one of the things I've taken away from these concert projects is that we all got the same notes. Mm-hmm. We just find different orders for them, and I try to find them as quickly as I can for the various projects. It's fun to do that.
I get the sense that you're really adept at both leading the gang and being a supportive team member.
Well, you know, I think quietly, Richard, the band's bass player is both of those. He's always the band leader, and he always leads the charge, so to speak. You know, in any group, Richard, he's the only person, he or she, sorry, ladies, they are the only ones who play every note all the time. Mm-hmm. That means they control the tempo, they control the changes, they determine where the beat is, they determine the pitch of the band, they determine sometimes the volume of the band. He or she is the only one that does each note has this kind of effect. And I think once we understand that plural we are able to have even more fun going to work night in and night out, which is why I go to work every night. I like those challenges.
You're 87 years old, and you're still performing and still practicing.
Absolutely. Well, my birthday was May 4. I had some nice friends over to say hello, and I'm glad to see you make it this far, given the world. Well, you know, I can't get better, Richard, unless I'm practicing what I'm aiming for. My general practice plan is I go into my practice room, and I have a goal in mind. What can I learn today playing these etudes that I didn't see yesterday? If I can cover that kind of ground and make up for those kind of missteps, so to speak, I'm really ready to go to work tomorrow night because I really figured out something to do that didn't occur to me the night before.
When you're working on your etudes, I mean, they are divorced from the music you're going to play.
Yeah, but it's still the same notes. They're just in different order, man.
So it's all about getting the tools in those fingers so that when your ears hear what the other guys are doing, you know what to pull out.
I want to be all over it. Absolutely correct.
We are chatting with Mr. Ron Carter. And Pittsburgh, the home of our radio station, WRCT, is a great jazz tradition. I think of musicians like Dwayne Dolphin and Roger Humphreys and George Benson and Ray Brown, Billy Storen, Eric Blakey, David Eisenzahn, and many more. What kinds of memories do you have about either collaborating with Pittsburgh musicians or coming to town to play?
One thing, I miss seeing Dwayne often. If you see him again or talk with him, give him my fondest regards and tell him I miss him.
All right.
Several of my school buddies from Eastern School of Music lived in Pittsburgh. And at one of our summer breaks, I drove from Rochester to Pittsburgh to pick him up and drive back to school. We had hung out for a weekend. 58 or so. Bill Motzing, a trombone player from Pittsburgh, really played really well and wrote nice arrangements. My other view of Pittsburgh is the jazz club that they had there. What's the name of that place?
Was it the Grill?
Yes, Crawford Grill. Back in the day, they had a knowledgeable jazz crowd. They came and have a good time, but hear the music. They always wore the latest fashions. It was like been in New York, only in Pittsburgh. Loved it.
Well, there's still quite a bit of jazz being played in Pittsburgh, and there's even a church that has jazz vesper service every month. Yeah, it's really cool.
I miss Nathan Davis, too, by the way. He's one of my friends from doing the clinics up there for summers. He was promoting the jazz community's music in and around the city. Lovely man. I'm sorry he's left the concert.
What is different for you about playing for a live audience, whether a club or a concert, or going into a recording session?
I guess three main things. The level of sound that's necessary, no matter how good the club is and how good their system is, the studio requires less physical effort to make the sound of the instrument, in this case bass, fill the room space. Mm-hmm. Secondly, given the quality of microphones and as engineers are learning to record the instrument music better, you needn't play so hard and so forcefully, literally, mm-hmm. for the duration of the gig in the studio as you would have to do in a nightclub. And thirdly, generally speaking, you're in a smaller spectator space. Generally, only the band is at the recording studio, so there's no other views or impressions you want to leave on somebody else who's not playing vis-a-vis the audience. In the studio, you're referring to and relaying to the members of the band, the producer, perhaps, an engineer. So your focus is limited to five or six people, and it's a lot easier to control that than having your view, your emotional view, your physical view, spread out over a huge room with 2,000 fans.
Has it been your experience that it's easier for the musicians to communicate with each other in a recording session?
Depends on the gear of the studio. Sometimes they have good earphone sets. Sometimes they're prepared to not have any at all. It varies on the situation.
As an amateur bassist myself, I know how important it is to listen and to be able to hear everybody so that, as you say, you can set the pace for them, but also support them in whatever they're doing.
Well, I think a footnote to that, Richard, is that it's important for them to hear me, in this case, me, the bass player.
Right.
Each note I play, and sometimes studios are not geared for that level of bass sounds and notes available to the guys in the band. I've seen some pictures recently of a studio when a quintet was playing in the studio and they had everyone in the same room. And I think that's not going to be, that can't be productive for the bass player, because given the space they're living with or playing with, no one in this group, no matter how quiet they play, can hear every note he or she plays.
Right.
I kind of demand that, you know, and I know that that situation that they're in right there moment, that's not going to happen. I don't mind note to go to waste. I think it's impactful for all those reasons I mentioned earlier about each note that I played does those things, and I think that they're doing a disservice to the bass player and the musicians when they are unable to not literally hear every note he or she plays.
Sounds to me like you sort of favor the setup where the bass player is in a separate room but with a glass to see the other players.
Yes, and I don't know how much time you have, but I'll tell you exactly why I feel that way. In an open space, where the bass player is in the middle of a room with no barriers around him, stacks of glass, the bass tries to fill all the space around it. Mm-hmm. However big the space is, the bass sound fills that whole area. By the time it gets to the microphone, the sound is so diluted because it's been played, it's been ringing around in this room for all this square footage, that the sound cannot be as impactful or as startling in sounding because the sound is delayed, it's decayed, it's dying by the force of the sound. By the time the force of the sound gets to the microphone, whatever quality it is. And I think to have the bass player more isolated in the room, that's a 6x6 room, it forces the sound of the bass, all of the sound, into the microphone that's now only 2 feet away rather than 25 feet away according to the room. No, I'm not a fan of that at all.
That makes good sense. So you always work with a microphone, or do you, when you play live, do you sometimes work through a pickup?
All those factors are varied. Generally, I have a pickup from David Gage in New York, a realist, that works really good for me. And the microphones, depending on where it's placed, depending on how close I am to the drums, depending on whether the piano lid is up all the way or halfway, all those sounds are feeding to my microphone. And as a bass is only one instrument times four, or whatever size the quartet is, that microphone cannot possibly isolate enough from everyone else's sounds for the bass sound to be more present in his microphone, quote-unquote his.
We are chatting with Ron Carter, and bassists out there, you're getting a lot of good tips here from Mr. Carter. As a teenager, I know that you switched from classical music to jazz, and I know that you also made a change from cello to bass, and my sense is that the jazz world is much more about can you play rather than are you from the right side of the street or the preferred race. Have you found that that's true, that the jazz community is more welcoming of more kinds of people?
That was the case back in the day. But I think if you take photographs of orchestras, classical orchestras, say the big top five orchestras from 1967 to 2024, I think you will see that the proportion of minorities, people of color, the proportion of graduates from classical schools, and the proportion of them in classical orchestras is not much better in that 30 or 40 year span.
Right.
When I was coming up, it was made pretty clear to me that orchestras, while no matter how good I played, the management was not prepared to hire a person of color in those orchestras back then. And my position is, I'm not sure that much of that has changed given the photographs you found on the internet. So having discouraged is a pretty strong word, but that's probably what it really was. A career in playing classical music, the jazz community welcomed me to New York to try to come to New York because all the players end up there. So there I was. I have not forsaken classical music. And if you didn't know my library, I've recorded some jazz classical songs, and I've have a nice classical music library in my home of discs and music. I'm still aware of the music, and I will try to play it whenever I get the opportunity to. Every Christmas, for example, high school orchestras and church orchestras need the extra bass players to play the Handel, the Hallelujah Chorus, or they may have a Brandenburg Society that needs bass players during the course of the holidays. I'm always available to those concert groups that I play as many as I can, as my schedule allows, and the availability of them. So I have not forsaken them. I still encourage the music. I endorse anyone who wants to play that. Go ahead and get your feet wet and enjoy what it does for you. I'm the jazz player in the meantime.
That classical background, I'm sure, has influenced the way you approach practicing and the way you approach performing.
Well, I think the biggest influence for me was, Richard, was how to practice. Back then, the competition as a 14-year-old, 15-year-old was stunning. Of all the good players who were already ahead of me in background and experience, and know that I could kind of make those being the big steps so far ahead of me, not so far back, and kind of even the score, was to know what I had to learn during each practice time. So before I sat down to my cello at the time, I'd figure out what do I need to make this practice time allow me to do with more ease, or a new fingering, or better intonation, a better sound. And when my practice time was over 2 or 3 hours, I'd stop and say, "Now, what did I learn this past two and a half hours, or whatever it was? Can I remember what that was, and translate that to the next practice time the next day?" I still had that mindset, Richard.
That's one of the many things that you'd like to share with other musicians. I mean, all these...
Absolutely.
All this knowledge and experiences, and I know you want to help us all learn from your experiences. So you've got a lot of information up at the Ron Carter Library at roncarterjazz.com.
Yeah, well, you know, one of my concerns, Richard, and this is my concern day, I guess, is that the most books that the jazz bass player is studying are built on playing, in this case, bass horizontally and as fast and as rhythmically and clean as possible. And I certainly admire that concept. My books are different than that. I try to teach my students to play as horizontally as possible across the bass. And my exercises are based on chords. Mm-hmm. My feeling, Richard, is that once the student understands harmony,
amándote a ti un día, mi corazón. siempre está en una carrera. Estoy cortando las flores antes de que sea primavera. ¿Dónde están los caballos? Los míos bien amarrados. La sangre y la suerte, aquí mano arrastrado. Tu amor es una avalancha, cae por su propio peso al existir. Ayer, hoy y mañana, la nieve en la que me quiero hundir. Menagle, cúrame, úsame. Menagle, déjame olvidar.
Seven heavens? Big deal. I want to see the eighth heaven, tenth heaven, thousandth heaven. You know, it's like break on through the other side. It's just like going through one door. One door isn't enough. A million doors aren't enough.
Coleta, quería ir de blanco y fui de violeta. La arena que en tus manos la sujetas resbala de tus puños y la aprieta. lloré cuando no quedé nada que perder. Ya no quiero perlas ni caviar. Tu amor será mi capital. ¿Y qué más da si te tengo a ti? No necesito nada más. Sauvignon Blanc a tu lado, mi futuro será dorado. Ya no tengo miedo del pasado, está en el fondo de mi copa de Sauvignon Blanc. En mi copa de Sauvignon Blanc. A mi Dios escucharé, mis limichu yo las tiraré, mi porcelana la dejaré caer y regalaré mi piano de pared. Estoy bien si estás tú.
erótica femenina hecha para el placer del sexo opuesto. Un auténtico robo de identidad, libertad y poder a mano armada donde todas somos invitadas. Y quien dice invitadas dice obligadas, forzadas, rehenes, prisioneras. Con cualquiera de tus compras tienes una garantía porque nuestra póliza siempre es para quedar bien y hacerte feliz, tenga el coste que tenga. Orgullosas de ser la empresa con mayor éxito en 2025, que más factura y más daño hace a todas nuestras hermanas. ¡Que viva la Electronic Puchaina! Que mi manual para lo mismo, para lo mismo. Y este manual para lo tuyo, lo tuyo, lo tuyo. Ya me liberé, te liberé, me liberé, te liberé. Me liberé, te liberé, me liberé, y te liberé. 激情任由, 是你当经常拥有的。 对不起我当然拿到我时间是短暂激情人女友是你当经常拥有的对不起我当然拿到我时间是短暂斯拉肉肉要我嘟嘟你若够可以当我地图 C'est la diva, c'est de Lulu. Todo por lo que él mataría y él dice que hay un trofeo que quiero por el que compito y ando soñando. Lo ilustraría cada día porque todo el mundo me va a brillar. Hay un llavero que quiero colgarlo con él, abriré todas las puertas que pueda encontrar. Y mi florero favorito no es el de gata, no, es la gata que yo tengo al lado. Se quedó sin, digo yo, del jean que cabe en su corazón. Él lo que quiere es el poder, no entiende que nosotras nacimos con él. Pero será verdad que un día lo entenderá. Guapa para Dios, me pongo guapa para Dios. Nunca para ti ni para nadie, solo guapa para mi Dios. Guapa para Dios, me pongo guapa para Dios. Nunca para ti ni para nadie, solo guapa para mi Dios. אם לחץ מייצר יא חלומים למה אנחנו כולנו לא מפריקים טויטו קומפרה דה קורסון אינספרבלס פרו נגו פסו Había un kilo sin col.
Everything that happened, as well as all their failures, and given that information, you have enough information to perfectly reproduce their model, right? So you should ideally be able to get up to some level of error, like the error, like the exact same weights or very similar weights, right? So when people say DeepSeek is open, it's definitely more open than an open AI model. But it's not open in the sense that, given the DeepSeek paper and infinite money, someone could reproduce their model exactly because the data is not released.
Interesting. Just a reminder, you're listening to Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. I'm your host, Arjun Das, here with Maxwell Jones, AI researcher at CMU. Speaking of CMU, obviously a lot of really cool ML research happens here that you're aware of. What are some cooler research or researchers that you would like to shout out as being particularly interesting at the moment?
So I guess I first want to shout out, I think my lab members are doing some really cool stuff. First, Shengyu Wang, who is working on data attribution. So this is actually a very hard problem. The idea is, let's say I trained my image generator on 5 billion images from the internet. And then I say, hey, generate me an image of a cat wearing a top hat. And I get some cat wearing a top hat. Like, the question is, can I figure out which of those training images were very influential into making that cat with a top hat? And I guess the main idea is, if I know that, then maybe I can give those artists some residual pay. right? So you can think of an artist opts in to getting trained, to using their data to train with a model. And then from there, if the model generates an image that was based upon their work, they get some residual fee. Right? This is actually an incredibly difficult problem from a mathematical and machine learning perspective. So Sheng Yu is doing some really cool work. I think also Gaurav Parmar and Nupur Kumari are doing some really cool stuff in the field of image translation and customization. So image translation is like, say you have an image of a car during the day. Can I turn it into an image of a car, like raining, right? Or can I turn it into an image of a car when it's cloudy outside? And so one application of this is like data augmentation for self-driving, right? So I guess more concretely, if I have a bunch of self-driving videos from the day, it'd be cool if I could generate self-driving videos during rain so I can use that to train to make a very strong self-driving car that I think will work in all cases. And then customization is kind of the idea of I have some personal images. Maybe I have some photos of myself. Maybe I have some selfies of myself. And then I want to generate like a high resolution professional headshot of myself, right? And so in this case, I'm only giving the model 5 to 10 images of myself as opposed to whatever it was trained on, like billions of images. And then can it use that kind of scarce data and its general knowledge about humans to then output a photo of me, but like say in a professional suit and in a headshot.
A lot of really neat stuff. Thanks. So speaking of these generative image and video models that you and your lab are working on, what do you see as some of the important implications in the future and potential uses? Obviously, it's hard to know exactly what's going to happen in the future, but where do you see the impact of this work?
So I think there's a few things. So one, I think there's kind of two areas that this technology can be very useful. And I think it's maybe a little bit different than what people think. So when people think of like, oh, I have like an image generation tool, they think of like, oh, like it's very negative. It's usually from a very negative connotation of, oh, it's going to replace someone. And so I think of it more as like someone with these tools can generate cool stuff much faster and can iterate on stuff much faster. So I'll give you two examples of like an expert with these tools being able to iterate much faster in the movie world, right? So first, like the movie Into the Spider-Verse, right? There was experts on the team that was like kind of designing, and they had AI tools that they could use to speed up their design process, to try things faster. And so to me, the result of this kind of technology is that experts can make a high quality movie faster. Right, so we don't have to wait whatever 6 years for the next Into the Spider-Verse movie, which no one would like to do. We'd like to have a really high quality version in 3 years, right? That's as high quality as a version in 6 years without the technology, right? So I kind of think of it as a continuation of any image editing software, in some sense, where it speeds up the use for creators. Another use case is helping people who are typically non-creators create high quality stuff that they can be proud of and learn more quickly. And so one example for me is like in the future, I'd love to make more YouTube videos, right? But some software like Adobe Premiere Pro or other video editing software is very, there's a lot of different tools you could use. It's very cumbersome, right? So it would be good if like AI could help me as a creator or someone that wants to be a creator create very high quality videos like immediately without all the overhead, right? Or could help me learn more quickly what a good quality video looks like. So I think this is another use case is kind of helping people who are not in the space or who want to get in the space, like create things more quickly.
You speak of generative AI almost as like a force multiplier, if I'm correct, right?
Yeah, something like that. And there's also like 3D assets or gaming is also another example that's kind of along these similar lines.
Yeah, so for our listeners who aren't machine learning researchers at CMU, but still want to use AI for positive impact in their own work, what are some ways that they can go about learning how to use these tools to boost their output?
That's a good question. So there's a few things, I guess. So first of all, the internet is a great tool. So you can look up stuff. Nowadays, if I want to learn about something, I don't know that much about it and I can't find it like via Google search, I'll just ask ChatGPT like, hey, I want to learn more about X thing. What are a set of things I should look up? Also, there's different AI tooling, especially in the generative AI space, that's more accessible, that doesn't require super fancy hardware. So for example, a tool might be like Comfy UI is a tool. It's like a user interface for kind of using these models. So I think that has like a relatively low barrier to entry as opposed to like trying to code up something fancy.
Sure. In general, what are some tasks that you see AI being really good at, and what are some tasks where it really still has some room to go?
So I guess, I was talking with some other like PhD friends about this. It seems like tasks where you're kind of just sitting around and like doing something on a computer like should be very automatable, especially kind of tasks that are not super long term. Where you're kind of sitting down and like typing or doing something that doesn't require any like interaction with the real world as much. So one example might be like writing reports, like writing write-ups. Any write-up where really all where what you're doing is kind of looking things up online, synthesizing information, writing things up in a certain format that's very nice, I think AI could be very good at. Right? Another example might be in the coding world, might be kind of fixing a single error in like a coding library or like a some kind of repository. I think that kind of task AI can be and will be very good at. Right? All these tasks are in some ways still kind of short term in the sense that you don't have to do stuff for a very long time. So some things that AI in general is bad at is just anything in the real world. Right? So robotics as a field hasn't hit its kind of ChatGPT moment, as some researchers like to say, where it's very widely adopted and everyone is kind of using kind of generalist robots, right? And so the reason for that is just manipulating things in the real world is just harder, right? It's harder to iterate. It's harder to test a robot 10 times than it is to test some code 10 times. It's just fundamentally harder, takes longer. Right? So I think that's an area where AI still has a long way to go. And then another area where AI might have a long way to go is kind of long horizon tasks, right? So I think one example is AI can perfectly pass maybe a job interview for coding where you're asked two very short questions. But can AI perform like a long-term like intern? Maybe this is more unclear. Right? And so I think people are working towards kind of this direction. But anything where there's super, super long like content that you have to create, I think is like much more difficult. Yeah, there's some types of things that AI I think might be like not as good at in kind of the social, like human aspect. So maybe like being able to synthesize new memes or something, like something that's like you have to be really in tune with the culture to do. But I could eat my words on that one. It's hard to say.
Yeah. Watch out for the new meme AI model dropping in 2025.
Oh,
right?
No. Oh, God. Well, I guess we'll see. People will definitely try.
Yeah. I'm sure it's going to come soon if it hasn't already.
Yeah. I know there's like YouTube creators that just do like they do video essays where they like synthesize the video and like the and the script with AI. And so that's kind of, I don't know, I like a use case where kind of you kind of have thoughts as a human and then you use AI as a mode to try to, you know, get them out there more quickly.
Yeah
or iterate sense on them more quickly. Yeah.
Yeah. I remember hearing a really interesting perspective on what AI is good at and bad at, that things that are like really easy or instinctual for humans actually end up being the things that AI is bad at.
Yeah, like, it's weird.
You could teach a 5-year-old to catch a ball, but to teach a robot like how to move its motors to like, I don't know, play hockey or something is like very difficult. But you see little kids playing hockey everywhere.
Yeah. It's one of those things. I think I forgot who it was. Maybe Ilya or some big AI mogul said it has like this kind of jagged intelligence, where the point is it can do highly intelligent things, but it still cannot do very simple things. So like it learns in a different way than humans are used to, in the sense that it can do very complicated things while still failing to do very simple things. Right. And so then the question is, how can you augment an AI to know when that's the case or to deal with that or kind of to not have to do that kind of thing? So one example might be like multiplication, right? Like, you can make an AI that knows a lot of stuff, but then still maybe struggles with 10-digit multiplication. Right? But if the AI says, hey, you gave me a 10-digit multiplication question, let me just use a calculator, like, maybe you can kind of patch some of these issues.
So as AI has been in the popular mind for a few years now, more so than ever before, do you think it's here to stay in terms of how people think about it? Or do you think this sort of initial burst of attention is going to go away?
I don't know. I think it's here to stay. And it's easy for me to say that as someone who works in the field, but especially after talking to like other people who aren't in the field or are like even like in like high ranking roles at CMU or other places where you'd expect them to be like more likely to say that it's not here to stay. I think everyone thinks it's here to stay. And maybe the reason is that, especially this generative AI stuff, it's so easy to use and it can give so much value that that value will kind of like circumcede any attempts to completely like stop it, is in my opinion. I think there's so much value that it can be output to make people's lives easier that people will just continue to use it. And whether the people think about it differently is another question. But I think there's a lot of value in people continuing to use this tool. But one thing I will say is with humans in general, like we go through cycles of having super cool new technology or something that's super cool and new, not knowing how to use it. And then after we know how to use it, it takes us even longer to realize why it might be good or bad. And then to kind of die down a little bit using it. So one example might be like smartphones, for instance, right? So smartphones first came out, whatever, 2000s, right? They got so much hype. Everyone started using them, right? And to me, it's now or in the next 10 years that people are going to start being like, hey, it's actually really bad that I'm spending so much time on my phone. Can I find really good ways to not do this, right? Because we're not used to it. It's almost like a... It's like maybe like drinking in moderation or something, where when you're first introduced to drink, you don't even know what it is, right? So you're thinking, oh, like I can do this a lot. And once you start to realize the downfalls, it takes even longer to be like, okay, how can I work on this, right? So kind of humanity goes through these things as well. And so I think this is something that happened with smartphones, where people kind of use them a lot. To me, we're kind of peaking in terms of how much we use them. And then people are kind of slowly being like, I actually really do enjoy like human connection. So in the last, whatever, year, I've heard more and more stories of people being like, yeah, I try to use my phone as little as possible. Or I'm actively trying to stop using my phone, which is something that maybe wasn't as true 5 years ago. So I really think that AI will go through something similar, where kind of right now everyone is using it. And in the future, maybe next 5 years, 10, depends, timeline is hard to say when things move so quickly. It'll get even more widely adopted and people will use it for many, many tasks. And then maybe at some point people will be like, we're actually losing some stuff for using it so much. But I think this is... if it's going to happen very far away.
Yeah, awesome. Well, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. It's been super fun.
Yeah. You've been listening to Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh. I'm your host, Archin Das, and I've been here with AI researcher at CMU, Maxwell Jones. Thanks. Have a good one, folks.
Peace.
This is a production of PBRTV.com.